You're listening to Drinking on the Job, DOTJ. I'm your host, John Coyle. Drinking on the Job is a toast to the culture of food, wine, and all things fermented. We'll be talking with winemakers, musicians, artists, late-night bartenders, scoundrels, and more. It's time to grab a glass before its last call.
Sam Doyle of Cambridge Wines joins me to discuss trends and what's happening in the wine world, and more importantly, his Instagram can give you the next 10 wines you should be drinking, period. So check it out. I don't know, but I've been told if you keep on dancing, you'll never grow old. Come on, darling, put a pretty dress. Anyone who listens to the show knows I have spirits people on. I have beverage directors on, but I'm so happy to have a fellow wine geek on today. Sam Doyle's here. He is the wine director of Cambridge Wines in New Jersey, an incredible store. If you don't know about it, you will know about it, and this is where you will be doing a lot of your shopping. So we're going to do the Coyle Doyle hour, I guess, on wine. And when I'm at the top, I have to thank Sam. He brought this incredible bottle of wine we're going to talk about as a gift, and we are drinking now. It is an Albarino. It's 2013. So give me the scoop on this,
yeah,
and thank
so,
you for bringing this.
I was actually with Enrique from IPO in his office, and he was like, hey, like, there's this wine, Paso Señorón. It's a 2013 Albarino. It spends 30 months on the lees in small steel tanks. And then it was late release, and it was the first wine Guia Pinin ever gave 100 points in the white wine category. I tasted it. To me, I'm a Riesling freak and a Chablis freak, maybe from my time in New York and spending and tasting with all these people. But it literally, to me, it's like Trocken Riesling meets Chablis right in the middle in this petrally, salty, minerally, seafood-driven wine that's just absolutely incredible. And it pours green, it pours young, and I'm excited to taste it 5 years down the line. It's pretty cool.
Thank you so much. He poured some in the glass, and I immediately, you know, it hit the wow factor for me. It's vinous. It's got viscosity, as Sam mentioned. It's not oxidizing color. It's still very vibrant. But, man, the salt finish on this thing is like, wow. But anyway, I want to say thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you're welcome.
For jumping on. So let's get into this. I want to, like, how did you get here? We're going to follow about what a great job you do and just communicating and educating people on wine in general, which I love what you do. But how did you get here?
Yeah, so it's been a pretty crazy long Jersey. I'm a Jersey boy at heart. I grew up in Hunterdon County, kind of farmland, but, you know, single mom, low-income condo. And I worked construction until I was 22. Kind of left that world and just looking for something new. I got hired in a restaurant that hadn't even opened yet by someone who some people may know named John Ross, who was the GM at the time. And he hired me on, you know, on the backbone of, you know, nothing about restaurants. That means you have no bad habits and I can mold you into whatever I want to mold you into. Right. On the other side is you're going to be a 6'2", you know, 200 plus pound busboy in a restaurant.
Yeah.
And, just being there and learning about food, Anthony Bucco is the chef, and I quickly realized that they had an ambition to be the best restaurant in New Jersey, and we got perfect scores from the New York Times, we got perfect scores from the Star Ledger, perfect scores from New Jersey Monthly, which is the trifecta of reviews that you want to get, and we won best new restaurant in New Jersey the same year that Natterar opened up, which was this huge project. Yeah, and to beat Natterar with the story behind it was such a massive deal to the restaurant.
Yeah, because Natterar is like Richard Branson financed. It's a mansion on a hill.
It's beautiful. I love it there.
The dollars they poured in, the tasting room, the private event space. But to beat them out,
to beat them out was so massive. And that's when kind of the addiction started. It was like, okay, how do I become a food runner to make $5 more an hour?
Right.
Learn the menu. How do I become a captain? Learn the cocktails. Learn something about wine. Didn't have to be huge. Just learn the by the glass list. And in New Jersey, that was enough for you to become a captain in a restaurant. And I became the head captain from Busboy. It took about 7 months for me to get to that point. And I was addicted. I was like, now what can I do in restaurants? Like, what am I doing? Where can I go? And a table came in, had dinner, a great time. And a couple days later, I found out that a woman at that table was the girlfriend of Scott Anderson, who owns Elements in Princeton, probably the best restaurant in New Jersey.
Sure, yeah.
Went to him and was like, hey, like, you should see if you can hire this guy. He's pretty good. And I knew Elements is the best restaurant in New Jersey, the only place in New Jersey doing 20-course tasting menus and elaborate wine list. Yeah. And I was addicted to fine dining, and John Ross, you know, exposed me to that. And I was like, I want to go work for Elements. So I took three steps back and started as a busboy at Elements and worked my way up to captain there in about 6 months. And just one day, we're sitting down for family meal, and my flip phone, because back then it was flip phones, rings, and it's John Ross again. He goes, you know, hey, you know, I'm in the city now, and I want to become a master somm, and one of the mentors in the city is a woman named Laura Menek, and she's opening a place called Court Buzz. And he was honest. He was like, I told her that you probably don't know anything about wine compared to anyone that, you know, will work there, but, you know, your service and your personality will be great for the wine bar. So I went and interviewed with Laura, sat next to a girl named Hillary Zio, who's amazing. She wrote a couple books and consults in the Hudson Valley. And I'll never forget, Laura asked what you would pair with fried oysters.
Oh.
And Hillary went on this beautiful rant about Chablis and champagne. And I was just like, I have no idea. And
you take a swing at it?
Yeah, no. Okay. I just didn't even have the 2 cents to come up with something like that. Still, Laura contacted me, and she's like, hey, like, you know, I still want you to come in, start as a server. There's going to be wine people around you, but I think you can learn something. And I was still in Clinton, New Jersey. It takes about an hour and a half to get to Union Square by car. And or by bus or anyway, and I drove or took public transportation for 3 years just to learn about wine from Laura.
That's so crazy.
5 days a week. I basically was making no money because everything I made went into either $20 tolls and $30 in gas every day. Or
oh, those drinks afterwards?
Yeah, drinks afterwards. Yeah. Public transportation to where I live is $40 a day.
Oh.
And it was just an experience knowing that I was never a city person like a lot of my friends growing up, but I knew if I wanted to do something in this world of wine and leave the wine industry or the restaurant industry at one point when I'm sick of working till 1 a.m, wine is my outlet. And I learned as much as I could from Laura before I went back to New Jersey.
See, it's crazy. I mean, I think people recognize insatiable curiosity and passion. People mm-hmm. recognize that, and they're like, I'll take this person on because they have, mm-hmm. you know, they have that fire in their belly that is sure. needed to pursue this kind of excellence. And I got to give a big shout out to Laura. She's mentored many, many people in this mm-hmm. business, friend, and her champagne list,
the
untouchable
yeah.
for price and quality, and such a fun, great place. It's one of my favorite places to go. So.
Yeah, I mean, and not only that, it's kind of like college. Like, I never finished college. I never yeah. went back to college. And the people that have come out of that restaurant, I mean, I know I've heard other podcasts talk about Morgan Harris and what he's yeah. doing in California. I have Paulo Fernandez, who started as a busboy. I met him at a party when he was 18. Laura had him as a certified somm 3 days after he turned 21. And now I buy port from him in New Jersey.
That's so crazy.
Chris yeah. Rafferty is the Gaia brand manager for Wilson Daniels, yeah. and I buy Gaia from him, and it's just there's so many connections. Alex Mazzanotti is at Byra. Like, there's so many people
yeah.
that is interconnected with that opening staff from Cork Buzz that I still not only work with frequently, but like I talk to all the time. It was like a real family.
Well, I mean, you're here because we kind of tangentially yeah, knew each other from
for sure.
from Cork Bars and Wine Library, yep. and like it's amazing. The wine community in general is very small.
Yeah,
even though I'm traveling, I run into people. I'll be in Bone and run into like Peter Liam, or yeah. I run into yeah, like yeah. you know a winemaker in Oregon yeah. will be sitting two tables away from me. It's
yeah, for sure. And then that point by like I can't think of the name, but by pure chance, Chris Cannon opens a restaurant sure. across the street, which was an Asian-Italian fusion. He consulted for him. And we used to go there and blind taste after work, me, Paulo, a couple people. And Chris one day was like, hey, like, you know, where do you live? You live in Brooklyn? I go, I live in Clinton, New Jersey. He goes, get the fuck out of here. He's like, and we start talking, and that's how Jockey Hollow conversation started. Yeah. And I went from Laura to back to New Jersey, was a somm at Jockey Hollow for about a year. And then I had my, you know, my opportunity to work a normal life job. And that's where the retail side came in, and I started a wine library.
Okay. Were you part of the original team that put like Wine Text together and all that stuff?
Yes. That, so I think, that was actually a couple years after I started there. Steve Fahey was there, who's I consider one of my biggest mentors learning about retail wine. Brandon, obviously,
Brandon's,
you know,
a great
Brandon.
Guy, yeah.
And I've learned so many amazing things from him. And Wine Text for me was like really organic in a sense that we got away from emails a little bit, specifically Steve and Brandon, and just started texting customers.
Yeah.
And we saw that there was like some kind of relationship there. And then Gary really built that idea out. And then that's how Wine Text started.
So what was your biggest takeaway from working from them? Because that's a huge, I don't know what dollars they're putting up now.
Yeah.
25 million,
so, I mean,
whatever that is.
For me, I learned more
under Gary.
I learned
himself
more about champagne from a place like Laura, but I learned more about logistics and business in a place like Wine Library. Good and bad. The good parts of learning retail and buying wine on that level, which I mean, some people in New York might not know about, like family planning and
sure.
stuff that we get in New Jersey that New York doesn't necessarily get the benefits of those things. But also being involved in the bigger conversations of bigger drops, like Wine Library is a store where pulling a trigger on four pallets of wine is not something that's not normal.
Right. That's 200 cases.
Yeah, 200 cases.
Right.
Yeah, right. Like, that's a normal thing at Wine Library. And getting into that world is something I learned a lot of. And I love that for that. But there's a lot of things that I didn't like about it. I felt like I was clocking in and clocking out a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like once I left Wine Library, I wanted to go home and not think about wine and not think about what I'm doing. And that just comes from bigger box and bigger, you know, the style of store Wine Library is and some of those conglomerate kind of wine stores and the route that they go. It just, you know, takes a little bit of the passion out of you, but, you know, you make a good salary and you're working 9 to 5, you're home and you're eating dinner at a normal time. You have Sunday, you know, weekends, and
you have
these things. You have a little bit of a life compared to the chaos that restaurants were. And I don't have anything against restaurants, but I felt like it just brought me down to earth a little bit. And then when I left Wine Library, coming to a place like Cambridge, I've like revitalized my love of wine because the brand is on the backbone of like purely just amazing good wine, which is like what I love.
Also, just to one step back, you also did that. We were the beer director at Wine Library.
Yeah, I was the beer director.
I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about beer.
Yeah.
Where do you think it's going? I see I had Damien and Marcella, they own Monk McGinn's, and they were talking about, and they're from Ireland, and they were saying how 00 Guinness is, and which I tasted, and I was like, gotta say,
it's not bad.
Athletic Brewing.
Yeah.
They seem to be able to do NA beer better than NA wine.
Yes.
I
but
don't
NA
know
wine's
why,
but a huge thing now, too.
What's that? NA wine's
NA
huge.
Spirits is massive now, too.
Yeah. What percentage are you looking at your store for NA wine?
I mean, it's not – obviously, I think that in American wine and working in places that we pull a lot of data out of and we can look at it, NA is a serious category. But in the overall aspect, it doesn't move the needle in the sense of it's not 10% of your business.
Right.
But it's something that people are asking for very, very frequently to the point where we have a full section of spirits, beer, wine, everything that's all non-alcoholic. And then not only that, some products that people are kind of getting in the half and half world that are like organically made or produced mixers that you can drink by themselves.
Huh.
You know, like, hey, add tequila to this. It's amazing.
You're right.
Or just throw it on ice because it's dry January and it's still amazing.
Yeah.
And that world is an interesting conversation as well.
A trend or here to stay?
I think it's here to stay.
Yeah, and grow, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take on it. I've been watching it quietly for years,
mm-hmm.
and I've watched people's followings just triple, quadruple, even brands. I follow brands, and I watch them go from 10,000 followers to 40,000 in 6 months. And that's not bots because I could tell comments and stuff.
Yeah, and not only that, especially in this area, and it's already happening in California and stuff, the marijuana community,
poof,
they'll drink a non-alcoholic cocktail all day to smoke pot or smoke weed and or eat edibles or whatever they want to do, to the point where like even THC sodas are a regular thing in liquor stores now, and that kind of thing is a movement that I see growing even more and more and more.
I see the beverage world gotten so much bigger. The funnel has just exploded because you have also people doing wine on beer lees and using beer yeast to help with the ferments on wines and champagne yeast. And it's kind of crazy. So it's gotten so interesting and so huge. I think it's such an interesting category. I had Petrovsky on from Massican before he sold. And
I love their Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh my God, yeah, the Massican white's fantastic. Awesome. And he said he wasn't concerned about NA. His biggest concern was cannabis.
Yeah.
He said, I think people are going to use more cannabis and then just not drink as much, period.
Yeah.
And all indicators are showing people are consuming less wine.
Yeah.
Fuck those people.
Yeah, no. Of course. No, I mean,
kill my business? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's just, I think there's a very health conscious world. There's an uneducated health conscious world as well that kind of blows my mind a little bit. But I mean, I think, we were talking about beer earlier, like beer even took away from some wine sales too. Like, it's not for me, if I'm willing to spend $40 on a bottle of wine, why wouldn't I be willing to spend $40 on a bottle of beer? And that's how I look at everything I drink now is, I'm drinking a lot better beer now. It's like, you know, and it's all relevant. So $40 beer is a no joke beer.
Give people, give people one of your favorite, like at that price point. So if they want to search it out,
cause I mean, I go out to like, you know, age stuff. I used to go to Good Beer downtown in New York. He always had a cool cellar. But it's usually like aged sours I'm kind of addicted to. Getting people who might not have legal bottles of things from Vermont that like, you know, you're willing to spend the money on. Yes, I could go up there and buy it for 20, but it's here for 30, 40, and I buy it here and I'm happy.
Sour beers is like a political moment for people. They're like, no way, no how. I'm not drinking it's sour fine. For me. I fucking love sour beer.
It so reminds is Riesling. Me.
Yeah, right. Like, that's
it's
true.
Like the same, same conversation.
But I just, I love the, but I'm a kombucha drinker, so sour beer has a little bit of that kind of VA to it, but really savory. I mean, I'm not drinking a ton of them, but like coming out of the hot sun or something like that, I could just knock one of those down.
Yeah, Hudson Valley sours. You can knock one of them down, two of them. It's like drinking two milkshakes sometimes. Yeah. They're so thick and fruity.
Yeah. I would say that your superpower at Cambridge is your educational videos. And when I say educational video, what I like about it is you're doing, you know, instead of drinking this, why don't you think about doing this? Instead of drinking the California cab with your steak, maybe you do a Brunello, and this is why. And I love that format that you do because there are a ton of influencers out there who are pushing wine, but they're pushing, you know, hey, this is the best wine you can get from Trader Joe's.
Yep.
So you should try this, so don't try that. And what I like is you say, if you like this, and because people who drink wine know this is what we do. We find something we like, and they go, oh, you know what? I'd like something. I'm going to try something that's slightly different. Yep. Mencia reminds me of Gamay, or Pais reminds me of Cru Beaujolais and meets Pinot Noir. But like to continue to try and compare and contrast and compare is what you guys do better with your overrated, underrated category, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Where did that come from, the overrated, underrated?
So Dan, who's the CEO and one of the co-founders, they've always had great social media, always had good talks. Dan's really good in front of the camera. And when I started there, it was like a question. Like, because we did some content for Wine Text back in the day, educational. It was a little bit different. He's like, hey, would you be willing to do some of the videos and film for us? I go, yeah, like, absolutely. I love that stuff. But the actual, like, ideas were very organic in the beginning, and it came from multiple ideas. One was when I worked at Uproot, my first job, John Ross, like, I was only a Budweiser, Jack Daniels guy. Still am, but...
I'm glad you mentioned like, hey, Budweiser.
I don't like Cabernet. Yeah, right. Like, this is disgusting.
Right.
I don't like red wine at all. Well, he would put six red wines in front of you and say, find something you like out of one of them. Anything, flavor, how it feels, whatever.
Yeah.
And once he found that, he would then break off and then go and try to find it. And next thing you know, I've tasted like a ton of wine. And now I'm like, I actually like this or I like that. So that's kind of where my brain was in the fact of that's just how a normal person would act. And when I was 23, 24, that's how I learned about wine. On top of that, it was a lot of missing tableside wines by the glass. You know, Laura didn't have a Pinot Grigio on the white wines by the glass when we opened. And what do people ask for is Pinot Grigio. And we had Albarino or we had a Sancerre. And it would be a conversation of like, oh, you like Pinot Grigio because it's light, it's dry, crisp when it's cold.
Yeah.
here's Albarino, and then their brains would just go, oh, that's good too.
Yeah.
See, and that's where it started.
And I tell people all the time, they're like, what you do is find something you like and then just continue to taste different stuff. Don't get stuck in the kind of the Josh meme.
Yeah. So that's really how it took off. And it, like I said, it's our videos are obviously the comments will tell you that we haven't overabundance of a single wine, or we're trying to push a bad wine or whatever. It's not true. Like we literally walk around the store with a camera and it's just, hey, let's do it this or that with Jordan. Cool. Jordan Brunello.
Right.
Why are they close? Well, some Italian wine in the comments will destroy me. But the truth is they're just full bodied red wines with a lot of tannin that goes good with steak. Right. If you like this, I guarantee you, you pop one of these and you have it with steak, you're going to be very happy.
See, this is why it works. You demystify, and at the same time, you don't insult. Because I remember you pulled up a bottle of Veuve, and you're like, you know, this is the Budweiser of champagne.
Sure.
And it's true, and I always called it the Coca-Cola champagne.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not shitting on it, because you just said you love Budweiser, and
of course,
here's your shot.
Well,
but then you go to what I think is great is like house and grower champagne.
Yes, yes.
So small family.
Really important to me is that, like I said, the video is – obviously, when we made the video or going into that video, me and Alex, who's our social media guy, I told him, I was like, hey, run this past the guys. Because if you post this video, I guarantee you, not only is it going to do really well, but we're going to get a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Because it's just a video that the way the new algorithms work with Reels and TikTok specifically, it's going to go around the world really, really fast. And once they said post it, if you really listen to the video, I'm not saying that Veuve tastes like Budweiser. I'm just pointing out that Veuve is so massively produced as a quantity compared to grower champagne. That's the analogy I made.
Right.
Knowing, though, people that listen to the video
are laughing going, yes.
I'm defending myself.
Yeah.
I know that real wine people, and you look in the comments, real wine people from France that drink wine, sommeliers, you know, wine directors and people in the industry will defend me to the grave in the in the comments.
Yeah.
But it's the people that know Veuve is this big luxury brand of LVMH are the ones that just heard Budweiser champagne and just had a massive conniption about it.
Yeah. But I they should know they're drinking Budweiser. And as you mentioned, there's nothing wrong with drinking Budweiser.
That's right. Absolutely.
95 degrees. I come inside. I'll grab a cold Bud if it's in the fridge. That's I'm not gonna say anything bad about it, but it is a big difference. I was in a retail store and I saw this woman buying like incredible wines, like beautiful, highly allocated, like Clos Regard, something else. Something. And then she had a bottle of Veuve Clicquot.
Yep.
And I couldn't help myself. I had to go over to her and say, hey, I'm really curious because like you buy all these really small producers that are hard to get, that make amazing wine. And then you pick up Veuve. I'm like, why? And she said, oh, you know, actually my boyfriend's a wine geek. But, you know, he said to buy some champagne, too, so I figured I would buy some Veuve. And I said, well, I have to tell you. And I brought over to
– of course.
And that was – it's not my store.
That's right.
But I'm like, if you really want to make him happy, drink some George Laval.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Drink some Pertois Morissette. Drink some Ouk. Drink something like this that are from small – and she was like, oh, okay. And she picked up something
else.
That's right. I love it because you – you know, we have similar ideas in that Washington State is one of my favorite places for wine.
Mine too.
They shoot themselves in the foot. And on the video, you talk about like, you know, yes, Washington State makes great cab and there's killer producers there. You know, there's the Bionic Frog and there's all really, you know, Andrew Well and all this stuff. But, you know, the truth is they make incredible Syrah.
Yeah.
And they do. And I love the Syrah from Washington State. And it's a value.
Yeah. And I think me running into Washington Syrah was really interesting because, again, working in New York with some of the best Psalms and talking to people, Syrah's a thing with Psalms. It's a thing. Northern Rhone Syrah specifically.
Sure.
And Northern Rhone styles. And I got into Washington Syrahs when I felt like that was the grape of Washington. And now, because Napa and California is becoming so expensive, I feel like Washington's shifting into being like we're a Cabernet town. Come drink our cabs. And to me, there were always some great ones, you know, from Washington cabs.
Sure.
But like, I always felt Syrah was their core. And now people don't even know that there's Syrah up there. And it like hurts my soul. So making that video was kind of like, man, like people should know that, yes, there's a lot of great value cabs up there. But like the real backbone is, you know, Charles Smith Syrahs.
Yeah.
And what grew Washington was not Cabernet to me. Yeah. It was always Syrah.
And we represent Sonder. Mm-hmm. I think Riley does an amazing job, and it's all farmed beautifully and organically. Mm-hmm. And you had a great thing about, I think you had Porter Creek, Porter Bass.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, hey, people are afraid that, you know, people are using chemicals and pesticides, and mm-hmm. maybe that's, they lean away from California, but there are lots of producers. Like Porter Bass, that are, you know, organically farmed, certified organically farmed, and doing the right thing in the vineyard. Steve Mathiasen comes to mind, Robert Sinsky comes to mind. Like, I mean, they're so, but to, like, you educate without hitting someone over the head, and you're like, this is really great wine.
Yeah. That is the most important thing. And there's a lot of fear, like the whole sulfites with headaches, the whole pesticides thing comes out because of influencers and content of people saying this is true when sometimes it's not true. Or there was like an article that said that like 80% or 90% of grapes grown in California are, they use pesticides or whatever it was. I don't even remember who wrote it, but the point is like people just took it as that 100% of California wines use Raid. You know what I mean? Like they like, you know, and I'm just like, man, like you're really like hurting the world. And people would literally, you can read in the comments, you can hear the people that come to the store and just be like, I don't drink California wine because of the pesticides. And I just have a conversation with them. Yeah. And I go, hey, like, you have to realize there's so many large producers when they're talking about the bulk amount of grapes being grown. There's so many big producers that own such a large amount of grapes there that are doing that. But the other 20% of the grapes, the 30% of grapes there, are all small family, you know, producers that are making incredible wine. They should never be shut out of a conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I also love your you did a great thing with Prisoner.
Yeah.
That Prisoner is like,
that was one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, the Prisoner versus Buckland.
Yeah, Buckland, which, crazy. That was one of the crazier stories.
I mean, because Prisoner is a mass producer. You have to go in there on the Instagram
feed.
They're
pinned up there. So.
If you just want to take a, you want like flashcards for great wine, check out their IG feed. It's incredible. And you'll walk away with like 20 new wines you want to try. That's for sure. But the Buckling thing was great because you draw the comparison again to something that is a mass produced product.
Yeah.
And then you have something like, here it is, and it's less expensive, and it's farmed properly, and it's a single estate.
And I'm also like kind of a literal person, as in I don't know how to say this like properly, but like I'm not the kind, I come from restaurants, so reviews sell wine, and I understand why they sell wine. I know that Buckland's good, but like I'm not the only one that says it's better than Prisoner.
Right.
That's what I look at reviews at sometimes. Prisoner's $20 more than this wine. But Wine Spectator, whether you want to read reviews or not, is also telling you it's better than Prisoner.
Sure.
And the story, the guy, the family farm has been there since the 1800s, and these vineyards are the original vine, and like there's so much history in there. And when we made that video,
did you catch it?
No. Didn't catch any shit from that. But the problem was we sold out of it by the next day because of it going viral. Distribution sold out of it by Monday. And the winery was sold out by the end of that week, and he had a bunch of people sign up for his club, and it was only because I pulled the bottle off the shelf to talk about his wine. And that was an aha moment for Cambridge Wines. Right. Our content was like, hey, like we can move the needle on a lot of things and sway people to try things new. Now I can't work a day without 10 people coming into our stores and just wanting to ask me questions, not about a video and want this specific wine, and just be like, hey, like I'm sick of drinking Josh. Like, what else can I drink? And walk around the store for 10 minutes. And they walk out with 6 bottles of wine.
Boy, that's great. That's what you want. And that's the power of social media, but also truth in social media, right? It's not like you say, hey, it's not, you don't have to shit on the Prisoner, but you say, this is what the Prisoner is.
Yeah.
I can shit on Prisoner if I want.
Sure.
I used to say, hey, the guy, the great name. He should be in jail for putting that in a bottle. I can say that.
Right.
But, but if people want to drink Coca-Cola, let them drink Coca-Cola. That's not your job.
That's right. I don't not carry the wine. Right. And when people want it, like it's going to be a reoccurring theme, but the Budweiser thing is you'll never change my mind on it.
Right.
You're never going to, you might look at me differently because I buy some of the best wines in the world and sell some of the best wines in the world, but you're not going to change my mind on Budweiser. It's engraved in me.
Sure.
So it's kind of my thing.
Yeah. I also loved your Piedmont thing. I'm a Nebbiolo fan. Yeah. You're a Nebbiolo fan.
For sure.
And I love the fact that you pointed out you can still get a great Nebbiolo at $15. Mm-hmm. But at $50, you're now in Barolo land, and you know, the king of Italy, as far as I'm concerned, for wines. I love Italian wines.
I wouldn't disagree.
Isn't it amazing to look at the gamut of pricing on wines? Because if you went back 10 years ago, I've been talking about this a lot, 10 years ago, people didn't buy Barolo for two reasons. They always said it's too expensive. And it was about the same price, actually.
Yeah, Barolo hasn't changed much.
And it was too expensive, and it never drank right out of the bottle. I went to Italy twice last year. I was in November. I visited Rinaldi. I visited Alessandria. I visited a bunch of producers, Trepile. And everyone from old school to who've been around for hundreds of years, and like, they're drinking right out of the bottle now, which is great. And that price point around the same has now kind of become the sweet spot on people's wine lists.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I just chalk it up to Napa Valley. Yep. Napa Valley is out of control. Five, 6 years ago, Stag's Leap Artemis was $40, and it's just about to break the $100 price point. Camus 2012, 40th anniversary, I remember when it was released, was $50 a bottle, and now Camus is a $100 bottle of wine in a matter of 10 years.
And increased production.
As the people that are drinking them in that $50 see that happening, they just become a more regular buyer in that $60 to $100 to $150 price point now. And now they look at something like Barolo at $50, and they're like, hey, that's a steal at 97 points at $50. And I actually feel more than Barolo, because I think Barolo is a little bit nerdier and it's harder to get people in it.
Sure.
But Brunello's been doing it forever.
Yeah.
Sure. Brunello's been the $40, 95 point wine for a long time. And the little brother Chianti, it was like, you could get crazy Chianti for $25. And they've been holding that for, I feel like, since I started in wine, and they've always been there. But Napa is now making those wines becoming the normal, just because they're in that lower price point, and we're the American consumer, and we see what happens in Napa, and that'll always affect everything else.
Also, the profile for a lot of those wines are kind of going out of style, or it's not people looking for anymore. Nobody's there. Of course, there's some, but like in general, 15% alcohol, a lot of new oak. People are like, I'm going to steer away from that. I'd like something a little more. That's where Brunello comes in. Brunello's just juicy. Sangiovese Grosso is just like a hug.
Yeah, for sure.
And again, you can find good Brunello at $45 a bottle.
Yeah, right? I mean,
and Chianti Classico, of course.
I used to like joke that Caparzo, her $30 Brunello was like, what are we even doing? Yeah. Like, I was like, I just spent $30 on a Brunello that could age for 15, 20 years. And like, this stuff is amazing. Now it's a little bit more expensive. It's definitely taking a lift. But I think in general, it correlates with, to me, in the American wine market, everything correlates with what happens in Napa, just how it'll always be.
Yeah. They definitely shot themselves in the foot.
Yeah, nothing you can do.
They'll slowly change. There are people out there doing like Mathiasen, who's like doing the right planting, and his cabs are coming at 12.5, 13.5. You know, understanding. If you're smart, that's what everybody should be doing. But
that's right.
You know, some people just have their head in the sand and like, I don't care.
I think people think high alcohol ages better. I think people think high alcohol means that you can drink two glasses of wine for the price of one, and you know what I mean. It's just like this mentality.
Yeah,
that's kind of like, I don't want to sound like this guy. Like, I hate Amarone.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. Yeah. Like, and people are like, oh, there's good 13 and a half. I was like, you're right. I'm sorry. I don't hate all Amarone.
Right.
But, like, the general public, they want 16% alcohol, the 7. And I'm like, man, like, how do you even, like, what do you eat with it? I've never been a fan of Amarone in the sense of, like, it was always just an unbalanced mess.
Yeah.
And I think Napa Valley like got to an unbalanced mess. They were always trying to over-extract, always trying to get the most alcohol out of it. And now, finally, because the cult Cabernet thing is becoming even bigger with younger crowd, in my opinion, and smaller producers and getting high-quality grapes, that they don't want 15% anymore, and now it's starting to catch them a little bit. Yeah.
Never thought I'd hear this. I've been at bars now, and I've heard people say, what do you have by the glass? It's low alcohol or lower alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I thought I would never, ever hear that. And, of course, people have Riesling.
Sure.
I've always drank Riesling.
They don't want Mosel, sweet Riesling.
Right. Yeah, I want sweet. It's got to be dry.
That's right.
They still have that problem. But, yeah, I mean, people are asking for it. So, to your point, people going the opposite. They're running away from 16%. Yep. What trends do you see happening? Are you forecasting on anything?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest trend, and I noticed it the most when I worked at Wine Library, and it's obviously continuing, is younger age groups try more things and don't get stuck in a rut. That's number one for me. What? Is the new generation coming up is not buying cases, they're buying mixed cases. That's such a massive thing going forward. Is people are buying, I have an older gentleman come in who loves Brunello, and you give him three Brunellos, comes back a week later and buys a case, right?
Right.
A young person comes in and buys three Brunellos, comes back to me, goes, I love your Brunello recommendations. Now let's find 12 different wines that aren't those three Brunellos.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is going to be the future of our generation. And that just comes from wine bars with flights, trying things all the time. I don't think we've ever seen
a deficit.
Yeah. Like, I don't think, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I've never seen, like, I see more and more people now when I go out, it's like they look at a cocktail list and they're drinking tequila, gin, whiskey, and vodka by the end of the night in four different cocktails. Like, back in the day, people were like, don't mix your alcohol.
True.
It's like, it's just people are willing to try new things in this gastropub world, and it's kind of translating into retail.
Yeah.
The other thing I see is, just like what we're doing, a lot of younger people being educated in not necessarily the finest wine in the world, but the wines that people want to drink more often, $20, $30 wines. People will always say, well, that's everything all the time. Like, that's the bulk of where people buy wine. But I think people are just willing to try more and just always willing to expand their palate more than I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Ever
seen. Hence the explosion of orange, skin contact.
Pet nats,
all that stuff is because people do, you're right, they want to try different things. And also they're a lot more conscious of what people are doing in the vineyard, how they're farming and who they are. Is important to a lot of that generation.
And I hope to bring a little bit more education to that too, because people that think organic hear natural, and they think natural means organic and not natural fermentation. Right. And the education we do is trying to like bridge that gap. But a lot of people just don't understand what that actually means and what it does. And talking to them, I want to try a natural wine. It's like, okay, unless I have this conversation with you and explain what natural wine means, you're going to go home and you're going to hate the wine.
Yes.
But if I explain to you what biodynamic wine is, and this is a still red wine made biodynamically, it's what you're actually thinking.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's a normal still wine and not a weird pet nat with like salty, grapefruity. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's the sour beer.
Maybe you take the natural wine anyway and you go home and you enjoy it and you come back and it's great. But like initially getting people educated on what they're actually drinking is going to be really important as we keep transitioning to all these new trends going forward.
Yeah, I totally dig it. I love it. All right, we're at the part of the show, man. And by the way, we're going to go drink some more wine. God says, Sam, thank you so much for educating and giving people value and really making them have some consciousness about what they're drinking and who's behind it. So he says, we're going to give you one last day on the planet. So your day is coming. So what are you going to eat on that day, drink, and what are you going to listen to?
Unfortunately, it'll be like two of the least conscious things because it's just who I am, is a Budweiser, a shot of Jack Daniels, and I'll listen to Steve Miller Band until the day I die.
He's
always my favorite band.
Any particular song?
I mean, The Joker is just such a classic.
Yeah, but, that's a great song.
I love Dance, Dance, Dance.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's my favorite Steve Miller Band song, and I'll always listen to Steve Miller Band no matter what.
I had it in vinyl when I was 16. I used to smoke pot in my room and listen to the end of Fly Like an Eagle.
Amazing song as well. Amazing song
And what are you eating?
Oh, man. Do I go the Jersey Boy pizza thing? No, I think I'm eating oysters. I'm an oyster fan. I'm an oyster fan.
So I'm a huge oyster guy. I eat my weight in oysters, and I have tons of podcasts about the oysters.
Sure.
But I love the fact that it just the wine guy's going Budweiser shot and some oysters.
Right.
That fucking makes me happy.
My girlfriend works for Whole Foods, and on Fridays they do dollar oysters, so we tend to crush some shellfish once in a while.
Oh, cool. Hey, man, I really do want people to follow you, and I want them to jump on your reels at Cambridge Wine, because it's the 30-second wine class. And trust me, folks, you watch the first 10 and you'll go, okay, I know the next wines I'm going to grab. Yeah. I'm grabbing them. And, so thanks for doing that.
Yeah.
And so how do they follow you?
In the Cambridge Wines NJ is the handles for Instagram and TikTok. We do some other things as well, but those are the main ones you're going to find me. And then for me, it's just at Samoman. It's been my handle.
Spell that out.
Samoman. It's been my handle since I was 12. Which has always been a thing of mine. And that's where you can find me.
Fuck, that's how young you are. You had a fucking Instagram or hey, when you were 12?
Oh, no. Okay. I'm saying my handle of all my life.
Oh, your whole life. Okay,
my whole life it's been that. But right now, that's where you can find me on Instagram.
Cool, man. Thank you for jumping on Drinking on the Job. People, check out past episodes for oysters and spirits and all that cool stuff on my website, drinkingonthejob.com. And thank you, Sam, for coming on.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to check us out at dotjpodcast.com. Until then, I'll see you at the bar. Dance.